17th, 2012. This is Spingola Speaks, and this is Deanna Spingola. I'm coming to you from the suburbs of Chicago. Thanks for joining me today on RBN for people who can handle the truth. Their website is republicbroadcasting.org. My website is spingola.com. During the program, please email your questions or comments to spingola1@yahoo.com. Join others in the Spingola chat room by clicking on the chat room button on my website, spingola.com, or by going to spingola.chatango.com. We will take calls in the second hour after we open the phone lines at 800-313-9443. My guest today is Michael Walsh, the author of The Triumph of Reason, The Thinking Man's Guide to Adolf Hitler. It is a compilation of Adolf Hitler's statements. He also wrote Witness to History, now available on Kindle at Amazon, and Behind Enemy Lines, The Reich Had Its Heroes Too. His latest book, which I just recently got on Kindle, is called Heroes of the Reich. It's got a very interesting cover, and I hope that all of you will purchase a copy. And you don't have to have the Kindle program or the Kindle device. All you have to do is download Kindle for your PC, and you can read it on your PC or your iPad or whatever. All righty. Welcome to the program, Michael.
Yeah, and it's lovely to hear your voice again and to speak to the American listeners. Hi to you all.
Well, it's wonderful to hear your voice again, too. I didn't realize that it had been a few months since we'd spoken. But I know you've probably been very busy, and I know that I've been busy. So I think it's wonderful that you have another book. And I do have it on my Kindle, or on my computer, actually. And I hope that, that others will have an opportunity to get it. So, what is going on in your life?
Well, plenty. I'm wearing about three hats, Deanna. And, you know, I'm keeping busy as a ghostwriter. This is my main source of income. And, of course, in between, writing new books. And, you know, you named a few titles, and you're very kind to do so. But I'm not sure about it. There's about 10. I've just published the third anthology of poetry. That is called Diamonds Last Forever by Michael Walsh. That is going very, very well. And most people will find the cover of it very novel and interesting and perhaps a little bit saucy. But in actual fact, that was yet another out of Heroes of the Reich, an artwork that came from the Third Reich.
Interesting. Okay, so Diamonds Are Forever, is that it?
Diamonds Last Forever.
Last forever, okay.
Yeah, you bet. Poetry never dies. It'll always be here with us.
And your poetry is fabulous. It's so moving. It's just so incredibly wonderful. I just, it's amazing. I can't believe that you produce that plus regular down-to-earth history. It's just, you cover both areas so well and so beautifully. It's just amazing. Very
Thank
admirable.
Thank you, Deanna. It's a gift. And I treasure the gift that I've been given, and I use it, and I share it. And it's going. I really do have an international reputation with the poetry now. And it was the editor of a very large European newspaper who said, now give us some evidence, Michael, of the international reputation that you have. And I sent her the testimonials, the tributes that I've received from all over the world, the United States, Russia, everywhere. And
That is wonderful. Okay, we're going to take a real quick 3-minute break. We'll be right back with our guest today, Michael Walsh. Michael Walsh. He is the author of his most recent book. I guess we need to say that the most recent is Diamonds Last Forever, which is a book of poetry. And then he also has the book that is called, and I have to backtrack here, Heroes of the Reich, and which I am looking at on my computer here. And I also was reading, from the Lithuania Tribune about Diamonds Last Forever, which is an article that came out November 18th of this year, and talks about your travels, and you do get around.
Well, I get around Europe, and actually don't get around enough, but it's a beautiful continent we have here, and it's similar in size to the United States, a little bit smaller geographically, but we have twice as many people who live here, and they cover a wide diversity of cultures, all white. So it's a wonderful, wonderful part of the world, believe me. I really like the joke. It was about the American tourists who were doing a coach tour through Europe years ago, and somebody asked what country were they in today, and somebody said, well, if it's Tuesday, this must be Belgium.
Well, it is a lot easier to certainly go about Europe. I know I was in France and Spain, and it just seemed like you could go from one country to another in just such a short time, and it was wonderful. I really enjoyed it, and the culture is different, and it gives you an opportunity to recognize that people pretty much all over the world are the same. They all have the same aspirations. They all care about their families and the values that they've adopted, and it's just, you know, people are pretty much the same all over.
You are so right, you know, because I was just going to lead on from Deanna and say Europe is still divided. On the other side, you've still got the likes of Bulgaria and Romania and Ukraine. Okay, I know they're no longer in the Soviet bloc, but they're still isolated by the European Union, and they're not allowed in, and they keep on knocking on the door. You know, Ukraine is the biggest country in Europe. It's bigger than France. It's a vast country. It's got 40 million population, and they're keeping it out simply because they don't want the competition. The Ukraine used to be known as the breadbasket of Europe. You know, it's a wonderful garden of Europe. And this is the reason that they're keeping them out. It's not ideological reasons or anything like that. It's political. And you just hit the nail right on the head. You know, when you talk to Romanians and Hungarians and Bulgarians and Ukrainians and the Czech people, all the rest of them, you know, they go to church, they go to school, they've got the same aspirations as us. Now, if we were all to meet at some great party somewhere, until they opened their mouths, you wouldn't know where they were from. But they've got such wonderful cultures, and they're not tapping into it.
Yes, indeed. And, of course, the Ukraine suffered terribly in 1932-33, and with the imposed famine, supposedly called one of Stalin's projects, one of his five-year plans, and the plan was to kill people there. And by stealing all of their food.
7 million people died, and that was a conservative estimate, Diana. The estimates have been put as high as 10 million people who died through deliberate starvation. I'm going to stop. Well, I've stopped talking about it being a famine. It was not a famine. A famine is a natural thing that happens, unfortunately, in places like the Horn of Africa, simply because the nature of the land is simply not enough to feed the population. This was never the case in the Ukraine. The population of the Ukraine is 40 million, and the land is so abundant, it is so rich, it is so fertile, it could comfortably feed three times that number of people. But their corn was sold, their crops were sold to repay the bankers in Wall Street who had financed the Russian Revolution, the so-called Russian Revolution. That's where the money was going. And it was, you know, they were paying off the bankers and using people's blood to do it, as always.
Oh, my. I hadn't heard that before. I didn't know. I thought it was just a depopulation program and did not think, oh, they sold all this food for money and let the people starve to death. And I believe that was the same situation in Ireland, where they took all of the food in the 1845-46 time period and sold it, because the Irish produced more than enough food to feed their country, plus additional food. But the bankers came in and took all of it.
That's right, and the Irish, of course, are surrounded by the seas, the bountiful seas, and they could have been encouraged to take advantage of the blight. They're only affected potatoes, and let's face it, the potatoes is only one crop. There are plenty of other crops, and people do get through their lives without potatoes. So it's not terribly important as it is. But, you know, there are still bountiful sea creatures that people can live off, and they do so in other parts of the world. So why weren't these utilized? Now, right throughout history, Britain, the Soviet Union, they have deliberately starved people to death for economic reasons and for reasons of population control.
Wow, so that's kind of a double whammy. And I believe the British did the same thing in India during the Second World War, where they starved several million people. Of course, they've been starving millions of people in India ever since they found that land, ever since they went there and started exploiting the assets, including the people of that land. And I think if you look at it, I think we're talking 30 million people or more.
Yeah, that's it's population control. It's just like abortion and other things, or homosexuality. It's a new way of controlling the population. This is the way they work, and of course they dress it up as being something entirely different for the greater good. Of course they would say that, but people really do need to get wise as to what is happening in their name. And famine or abortion, it all amounts to the same thing. It's a genocide of the race. Race mixing is the same. It's genocide of the race, and I speak not only for my own race, but I speak for others. And, you know, I think that their race needs to be maintained just as ours does. And it doesn't do us any good at all when the race mixers move in. It doesn't create a race. It destroys two races.
Indeed. And, of course, multiculturalism is something that a particular ethnic group is pushing, despite the fact that most countries do not want multiculturalism. And but it seems that they don't have a choice.
Well, I want to see them start ramming it down the throats of the Japanese or the Chinese, and I can think of a few other countries, and they'll be given short shrift, won't they? But I don't know. We whites seem to be suckers for that sort of propaganda, and it really is destroying our people, our race, and now it's just causing meltdown in our society. It's destroying our sense of togetherness, and of course, that is their aim. But they wouldn't get away with it if they tried it on the Chinese or the Japanese. They don't mix themselves, and the Jews, of course, don't.
Michael, it seems that your audio is kind of fading in and out. I'm not sure. It sounds like you're going underwater every once in a while. You're not in your swimming pool, are you?
I didn't want to mention this to you, you know, but I got my goggles on, my Brockman's flippers on. I'm speaking a bit closer to the microphone now, perhaps.
Okay.
I get pretty relaxed here, sitting here in my home studio, and just sitting back. I'm talking to you as if you're at the far end of the room. Sorry about that.
That's okay. I have a headset, but sometimes when our guests have, another type of setup, then... You know, it isn't, you can kind of tell, but anyway. Well, as long as you're not out in your swimming pool, then I'm sure we'll be fine. You were talking about population control and that they kind of spin it as something else. And, of course, in the United States, they spin it as freedom of choice. And and people buy this. People bought into this. Women bought into this. And they don't even realize that they have been so incredibly duped that they are willing to murder their children and call it something else, when in fact it is deliberate depopulation and population control. And with these almost 57 million people who are no longer around, then they can bring in another ethnic group to take their place. Perhaps people who will work cheaper or work harder or don't need the protection of, for instance, from dangerous machinery or whatever. It's just amazing how they operate behind the scenes, behind the curtain.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, because what they're doing here is any nation which is culturally unique, any nation in the world, it's a thorn in their side. There is always a possibility of them rebelling as a people, as a sole people. But if, as you say, by various means, homosexuality or abortion or mixing the races, they can reduce the number of people and make it a polyglot country, then they've got less to fear.
Right. Yes, you don't have that unity. If you have several different races existing in one country, those people typically are not going to unify. They'll kind of stick with their own group, which is unfortunate. Alrighty, we are coming up on a break. We will be right back in 3 minutes with our guest. Stay tuned. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Michael Walsh, and he is the author of several books. His latest one on poetry is called Diamonds Last Forever, and he has another book which is available on Kindle. It's Heroes of the Reich. And one of the people in the chat room asked if you were calling in from Atlantis.
yeah, but
we have a lot of funny people in the chat room. And somebody else mentioned that the Japanese birth rate is so low that they will have to accept multiculturalism. Do you find that true in other countries also?
Yeah, well, just as you are having a break there, I was reading a Polish newspaper, and I'm just quoting from it right now, Deanna. The Poles are putting off having children sometimes for too long. The country already has one of the lowest fertility rates in the world, and if current trends continue, it may well top the global childlessness ranking in the not-too-distant future. There you go.
Right.
Just what we were talking about. You know, these are wonderful people. These are our people. You know, never mind the breakdown of the national borders that are artificial anyway. These are Europeans. You're European. You know, we've got to do something to save our race.
Indeed. And not only is it just people deciding not to have children, it's that many people have become infertile because of the things in the water, in the food, and people are not able to have babies. And that didn't used to be the case.
Yeah, it touches upon the many reasons for it, the social, and as you've just said, there are reasons that people are becoming less fertile than they used to be, so there are economic reasons for them to keep the children, you know, down, whereas their parents would have four or five children and not think anything of it. Now they're having two children, and of course, if you have a mortality rate, then they're just simply not replacing themselves, and they are in decline. And we don't want to see Germans in decline. You know, this is what wars do to people. It reduces the population, and if there are no wars taking place in Europe, for which they've impudently given themselves a Nobel Prize for, then they're reducing the population by other means other than saturation bombing. They're doing it through abortion and race mixing and changing the economic climate so people just can't afford to have children anymore. But they're achieving the same aims as they did in the Ukraine. They are reducing the population to what they regard as a manageable level. And as Lenin said, 3/4 of mankind may perish so that the rest may experience communism. They're doing exactly the same thing.
Wow, that is interesting. Somebody in the chat room wants to know your ethnicity.
Oh, that's a very, very good question, because I'm not quite sure of the answer myself. You know, so we go for European. Very often I'm asked this question, and I say, I'm an Irish national. I hold an Irish passport, but I was born in England to Irish parents. Because of the job that I do, I'm living in Spain, and if it's a preference, then it's got to be Latvia, the Canada of Europe. So, you know, what am I? Am I Irish? Am I British? Am I Spanish? Or am I a Latvian? I just say, I'm a European.
Okay. That's good. All righty. Well, let's chat a bit about your book, Heroes of the Reich. And I just have this feeling, and it's based on some of the email that I get, that people are starting to really understand the truth about World War II and about Adolf Hitler and about Germany and about the fake holo hoax. And it's like I can feel and I can also see kind of an awakening. I mean, not a huge awakening, but certainly within the so-called truth movement, because there's more and more people talking about it. And it's due to people like you and your books that this is happening.
Shall we call it a stirring in the human breast, Diana?
See, you're so poetic.
Okay. I find exactly the same here. Now, this will be of interest especially to American listeners, because a book has just hit the bookstalls, and it's about the Charlie Brown and the Fritz Stiegler country. This is where there was a United States Air Force bomber that was returning from a bombing raid in Germany in war, of course, and it was very badly crippled, and the crew were all shot up, and there was no way that they were thought to be able to get back to England. And so a fighter pilot from the Luftwaffe went up to try and encourage them to land and be taken prisoners. But they refused to do so. They wanted to get back to England. And he actually escorted them to the Channel to make sure that they got across there safely. So this story is a big story in Europe at the moment. But what is interesting is the reader's reaction to it. And again, you're singing my song. The people who are responding to this are saying, yes, the war is over. Let's look at the other side. Let's look at the heroes of the Reich. They have their heroes too, and let's just move on.
Right. But I think it's really important. So are the commercials here at RBN. And so we're going to take one right now, and then we'll be right back in 3 minutes. Welcome back. This is Deanna. Our guest today is Michael Walsh. He's the author of many, many wonderful books. His latest one that we were just going to talk about right before the break is Heroes of the Reich, and it is available as a Kindle book if you have the Kindle device. Great. If you don't, you can download the Kindle program on your computer, and you can read it on your computer or your iPad or iPhone or whatever. But anyway, history is very important. Some people will say, oh, come on, it happened a long time ago. We don't need to revisit that. But the fact is that many of the things that are occurring right now are doing so because of history and because of the misrepresentation and rewriting of history. And it's important that people know the history of their country, of other countries, so that they know who they are.
Yeah, people like to, they do like history in a way. Otherwise, you know, the movie Gladiators was a very, very popular movie, and so was Dr. Zhivago, about two completely different periods of history, but it was history nevertheless. And we found it absolutely fascinating. And when we were children, we were inspired by great men who did heroic deeds. And we really didn't take an awful lot of notice of exactly where they were born, and we certainly didn't give anything about what their politics were. We were just inspired by their mighty deeds. And this is what inspired me to write Heroes of the Reich. It has 80,000 words in, so it's a big, thick paperback size, and it covers 40 chapters, and they're all important. Now, forget the Third Reich, if you want, because half of the people, the heroes in there, probably never wore a uniform in their life. They just happened to be on the losing side. But their deeds were really inspiring, and there's, as I say, there are 40 chapters, and it's not just Germany. You can just leave Germany out, and you still got half a very good book. You know, you got the heroes who fought on the side of the Axis, or they served in some way, perhaps as musicians, the Axis, And they came from Austria and Switzerland and Norway, England, Romania, the United States, if you count William Joyce, and why not? The Netherlands, Belgium, France, Spain, Estonia, Russia. All of these people were part of the enemy, if you want to call it that way. And they all produced their heroes. And this is a tribute to all of those great men and great women. And on the latter point, it is interesting that so many of them were the ladies. Wonderful, absolutely wonderful.
Indeed. Oftentimes, we never hear about the females in history. We just hear about the guys. And I like to hear about some women that did some great things also.
Well, of course, where would they? You know, the war wouldn't be the war, the Second World War, without Lal Anderson, you know, of Lily Marlene, you know, which is the most popular war song of all time. I think it's been broadcast and re-recorded in about 56 different countries and lands, even Hebrew. So there was absolutely no stopping the ladies when it came to representing the Third Reich and all of its interests. There was Elisabeth Schwarzkopf, the wonderful opera singer, the soprano. You know, she was a legend, as so many of them were. And then those from the Netherlands, there was Florentine Ross van Tonningen. An absolutely wonderful lady. There was just no shortage of them, really. There was Winifred Wagner. She might easily have married Adolf Hitler, and she was an English woman, would you believe? So the woman, I thought at the time that I am going to write a book called The Heroines of the Third Reich, because there's certainly enough of them.
Indeed, you could probably write just as big a book about the women.
Or Americans as well, because I'm just having a look here now. One was an American, although he was German by birth, and he's a great American, a really great American. And, of course, I'm talking about Wernher von Braun, the rocket scientist.
Indeed. And he probably was an unwilling immigrant to, this country, but certainly did contribute. Of course, I don't believe that Americans went to the moon or that anybody else went to the moon, but I do believe that he contributed. In fact, he actually said that it would have taken a ship the size of the Queen Mary to get to the moon, with all the equipment and everything else that they showed that they had. But he did contribute a lot, as did many Germans, after the war. And before the war, because a quarter of the people that lived in this country in 1900 originally came from Germany, and they are the people who made this country what it is. They brought their values and their hard work and so many other things, and contributed so much to the greatness of what America was.
Yeah, and I was just thinking before, as I do, if some of these people, regardless of their uniform, had they been wearing an American uniform rather than a uniform of their home countries, you know, the Americans or the British, they would have been making television programs about their acts of heroism and the great deeds that they did. But it's wrong to isolate these people, to ignore these people simply because they were wearing a uniform that we don't approve, because we're denying ourselves great stories of inspiring people who inspire us because they were human beings caught up in the times, on the wrong side, as it so happens. It could so easily have been us on the wrong side. And would we want history in the future to deny us our great people simply because we had lost the war? That is wrong. Let's keep politics away from bravery. They're two separate things, and bravery is totally alien to politics anyway.
That's an understatement. separate from politicians, definitely, who are mostly scoundrels and ne'er-do-wells and psychopaths. But anyway... who is your favorite hero in this book?
Well, it's a difficult one. I think I wish you would break it down into nationalities, you know, because it would be not Hansen, it was Norway. And in Belgium, of course, it would be Leon de Grel. And if it was Ireland,
let's talk about him. Yeah, let's talk about him.
Yeah, he was a great character, Leon de Grel, wasn't he? And, again, this is the point I'm just making, is had he done what he did for any of the nations that were fighting on the Allied side, you would be watching movies and reruns and television dramas about him. You'd be reading books. The kids would be being taught about him. But because he was a Belgian and he fought on the other side, you know, we don't hear anything about him. And that is so wrong, so wrong.
Indeed. Indeed it is. Whoops, I muted myself. I muted myself to take a drink of my kombucha. But yes, it is very wrong for people not to know about him. And he produced quite a lot of literature or books that are not available. There was supposed to be a whole series of his writing, and it didn't appear because somebody just decided that they were going to conceal it. And the Barnes Review recently came out with one of those books, and it's called Hitler Democrat, which you can get from the Barnes Review. But most of his writing has been hidden away.
Well, why should we deny the current generation? Because I'll tell you this now, Diana, in a generation or two, these books will be read by everybody simply because they will have removed themselves that distance from the war. So we can look at books now that were written in the Napoleonic times but were forbidden at the time simply because the wounds were still raw. But now we're able, with the distance of time, to read these books. Why should we be denied, you know, access to these books by the likes of Leon de Grel?
Sure. Well, I think that probably one of the reasons that we don't have a lot of the books, and we'll never have a lot of the books, particularly out of Germany, is because the Allies destroyed 35,000 titles, including all of the textbooks from 1933 through 1945. And this information came from Michael Collins Piper, the Allies, when they went into Germany, part of destroying a culture, which is what they wanted to do, they wanted to make Germany just an empty wasteland. And part of getting rid of that culture, not only do you kill a lot of the people, but you kill their history, and in that case, they pulped it. And yet we constantly hear about how Hitler, oh, that horrible Hitler came in, and he destroyed some of the books. Well, he destroyed less than 5,000 titles, and you probably would say, okay, I wonder what he destroyed. I'll bet it was something that was very detrimental to the German culture. But when you're talking about the Allies, we never hear that they destroyed anything, and yet they destroyed 35,000 titles. Different, you know, 35,000 different titles. And so when you destroy, when you wipe out all of this history, and you wipe out all the education, which apparently was part of the denazification program, and I personally believe that the denazification program was a worldwide effort and a worldwide operation, to not only make the Germans forget what they had, particularly their economic program and their unity, their unified society. I believe that that they wanted to wipe out any history or any indication of what they had for the rest of us.
But it was an interesting thing about the bonfires of the books in Germany. I was reading up on that too, and an interesting, a fascinating aspect of it, Diana, is that it wasn't the Third Reich, it wasn't the National Socialists who started it. It was an impulsive thing that was started by the university students of the city of Leipzig. And they were so fed up with Marxist books and pornography and books that were degrading Germany that they acted on their own initiative, and they went out and they held a public bonfire of all of these debased books that were in the library at Leipzig University at the time, and it caught on. And the National Socialists sort of took advantage of it, and they thought, well, this is not a bad idea. But it was a symbolic thing rather than a destructive thing, such as you've been talking about. So all of the books weren't burned. It was a symbolic burning of pornography and communist basement and all of those books that were denying Germany the great history that it had. They were burned, but it was symbolic. But there was never any attempt to erase history from the face of the earth, such as the Allies did at the close of the war.
Well, I really appreciate you telling me that and telling our listeners that. That seems like a fantastic idea. And in fact, when you think about some of the trash that that poses as literature here in this country, I can think of a lot of things to burn. A lot of books should be burnt. A lot of things, you know, we say, oh, well, we just won't watch TV, or we won't go to the movies, or we won't read those trashy novels. But that's just not doing something. This is something that's a little bit more proactive. Like having a bonfire in the middle of the street sounds like a nifty idea to me.
Yeah, sooner or later, I'll tell you, it's going to happen, because it's happening in Europe now, Diana, is you're going to have a group of American concerned citizens, and they're going to go into some of the bookstalls, and the police will probably be too slow to react, I hope. And as a symbolic gesture, they're going to clear the top shelves, and they're going to set fire to it, and it's going to be symbolism. And, you know, perhaps it will catch on. This is the way governments are brought down. It always starts with a very small spark. It happened that way in Poland and in the Czechoslovakia and the other countries. And I tell you now, it's happening in Europe. And we're seeing levels of police brutality that I never, ever thought that I would see in a Western democracy because of the, you know, the anti-government riots that are taking place in Europe now. You're being denied this news in the United States, but believe me, it is happening. Europe is a tinderbox.
Oh, my. Well, we do see the riots, but, of course, they spin them in a totally different way. They don't characterize the crowds as people who are just demanding their rights, but they characterize them as people that are out of control, and I mean, it's just spun totally, totally out of sync with what reality is.
Yeah, you Americans are playing a very big part in it as well. You know, the Wall Street lot, you know, they are inspiring Europeans, because this is really a war against the bankers. You know, we turn our anger against the politicians, but the politicians actually are marionettes, and they are doing what the bankers want them to do. And they are torn between the middle, the politicians. Now, I'm not sticking up for the politicians. I hate them as much as most of us do. Despise them. But the reality is the politician is the piggy in the middle. On the one hand, he's got the bankers, and on the other hand, he's got the people, and both are applying pressure to him. And what we're going to see in the United States and in Europe is who wins. Is it the bankers? And do we turn into the Soviet Union of Europe and the Soviet Union of the United States? Or do we turn into a people's republic? I hope the latter.
Right. One person in the chat room said, if we burned all the kosher books here in the United States, we wouldn't need libraries.
Well, the internet will bring them down.
Yes. Oh, goodness. Well, about Leon Degrelle. How did he happen to serve Germany rather than Belgium?
He was a Catholic, and Adolf Hitler was, of course, and he was fervent in his faith, and he was a strong nationalist at the same time, and he was drawn, as so many people were, into the changing political situation at the time, and it was a time, my parents included, you had to make a decision one way or the other, and he believed in the new order that was replacing the old order of communism and capitalism. nationalism, best portrayed by National Socialist Germany. So he joined in that.
Going to a break. We will be right back with our guest today. Stay tuned. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Michael Walsh, and we were talking about Leon Degrelle. And you mentioned just before the break that that there was a third way there, that would be National Socialism, as opposed to capitalism and communism, both of which were created by the same ethnic tribe. And both of them are destined for failure for the common person, but they are created to embellish just certain people and to enrich certain people. So tell us just a little bit about the three or at least National Socialism, as opposed to the other two.
Well, National Socialism was the genuine revolution we talk about, and I wish we would stop because we sort of parrot what we've heard before. It's natural, I suppose. We should stop calling it the Russian Revolution. It was the Jewish Revolution. They were doing exactly the same in Russia as they're doing today in Syria, and they did yesterday in Libya. They sent in revolutionaries to overthrow the legitimate government, and the government in that way was taken, commandeered, if you like. And this is what happened then. And it was totally financed by Wall Street, the Jews there, they were running the banks almost exclusively, and they financed the Bolshevik Revolution. This is perhaps a more accurate description of it. And it was common, you know, it may not be commonly known now, not to today's generation, but in the 1920s and the 1930s, there was absolutely no secret about it. Adolf Hitler wasn't the only one. Winston Churchill, everybody knew that it was not a Russian Revolution at all. It had been the takeover of a country financed by Wall Street using largely Jewish revolutionaries. They were running the entire prison camp in the USSR. So, of course, you've got two sides, what Adolf Hitler described as two sides of the same coin, capitalism and communism. So you needed a people's revolution to recover the situation and to deny capitalism and communism, you know, the way in which they subjugate people on both sides. And this is the emergence of National Socialism, and this explains to people who can't figure it out why capitalist United States and communist Russia were so closely involved in the destruction of the Third Reich. It was because they were both the same thing, and neither of them could tolerate somebody that would overthrow both systems. And I don't mean militarily overthrow. The United States was never, ever threatened. It could never be threatened by National Socialist Germany. No, what was happening is when other countries in Europe were seeing how well the economic system of National Socialism was doing, they all wanted a slice of the cake. And Romania, Hungary, Bulgaria, they were all starting to copy the German way of doing things. And this was spreading. And, of course, that would have spread to the United States. And it would have been the United States people who would have said to the Wall Street of their time, the government of the time, Capitol Hill, we want to do it this way because we in the West now, under the Western capitalist system, are laboring under a 40% interest charge on everything.
Indeed. All righty, we have our 60-second top of the hour break. We will be right back with our guest today, Michael Walsh. Stay tuned. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and this is the second hour of Spingola Speaks. People often question why the communist and the capitalist, two allegedly different systems, ganged up on Germany in World War II. Our guest today, Michael Walsh, just explained it. Our guest, as I said, is Michael Walsh. He is the author of The Triumph of Reason, The Thinking Man's Guide to Adolf Hitler. It is a compilation of Adolf Hitler's statements. He also wrote Witness to History, and many of these books are available at Amazon. He wrote Behind Enemy Lines, and his latest book, is called, what is it called? It is called, I have to scroll up here.
Heroes of the Reich.
Heroes of the Reich. I just like scrolling up to see that picture.
Yeah, what a great movie to make. I tell you, you know, if any television producers are listening, then you got 40 wonderful dramas here all waiting. And I tell you, the American people just will not be watching anything else while they're watching the programs on these great human beings.
Indeed. One of our chat room participants wants to know about Albert Speer. Was he a hero? Was he a villain? He's a very interesting individual. What can you tell us about him?
Albert Speer was a bit like, say, Herbert von Karajan and Arno Breker. They were men of their time. Albert Speer, had he been born in the United States, I have absolutely no doubt that, like Wernher von Braun, he would have become a very great American. But first and foremost, he was a major planner. He was an amazing architect, and whichever country he was born in, I don't think that these people are political by nature, not as perhaps I am. They vote simply because if you're in the United States, you either vote for the Republicans or the Democrats. But most of those people who vote, including the well-known people, the composers, you can't say that, say, a great American conductor at any of your great metropolis is a Republican. You don't speak of him in those terms. You couldn't care less. He's a great conductor or he's a great artist. And it was the same in the Third Reich. Some of these great sculptors and, as in his case, architects, and as in Beatrice's case, a soprano, they would have been great wherever they were. So I don't think they can be labeled in a political way.
That is what I like about you. You have this ability to get right down to the facts and explain them so that it just, well, that's obvious.
It's pretty straightforward. You know, most of the people are not really political. Okay, they vote one way or another, whether they're in Britain or Spain or Russia or whatever the case may be. But they're not really political animals, and they really don't understand. They just want to get on with their lives. And they've perhaps got creative abilities. They may be great writers, great poets. They could be great architects or artists or musicians. It really doesn't matter. That is all that is important to them. And it's totally irrelevant. So your great musician in the United States, they would have been great musicians had they been born in Russia. So, you know, they're not really, we really can't put political labels on these people.
Or we could also apply that for instance, we have all been indoctrinated to think of other people as either our enemies or our friends, when we just should be looking at other people as just people like us. And then we won't get the idea that these are people that need to be destroyed and killed simply because the media and the politicians say, oh, these are enemies. All righty, we'll be right back in 3 minutes, and we'll pick this discussion up on the other side. Guest today is Michael Walsh. He is the author of many books. And while we were on the break, I ran downstairs to the downstairs bookcase and grabbed a book off the shelf. Well, actually, it was on the card table or the coffee table, called Hitler's Engineers. And it is about Fritz Todt, T-O-D-T, and Albert Speer, and subtitled Master Builders of the Third Reich. And it's by Blaine Taylor. It's a beautiful, big, heavy book. It's got all kinds of wonderful pictures in it. And I was also thinking during the break that while Germany seemed intent on building up the country, on building up the people, on unifying the people, that the Allies were intent on destroying not only Germany, but anybody or any country that would follow in Germany's footsteps, and that they did this. This was a kind of a precedent for what would happen to other countries that did that. And you've already mentioned some of those countries, Libya. And so any other country that follows in Germany's footsteps, this is what they can expect.
Yeah, nobody, NATO really is the bankers' heavy boys. You know, when you don't pay your bills and the banks tried every which way to get you to pay your bills, then eventually they're going to send the bailiffs round to your door and they're going to remove all of your priceless belongings from your home, and then they're going to put the padlocks on the door, and then they're going to deny it to you. And that is exactly what NATO is doing. They're not carrying out the political will of the politicians. The political politicians are sending them in on the bankers' orders. Colonel Gaddafi was very, very much a rebel. They had their own independent economic system, and the money was going right back to the Libyan people, and nobody was creaming it off, and that simply would not do. But really, he sealed his own fate when the other American nation, sorry, the other African nations started showing an interest in following his example, Nigeria and Ghana and quite a few other countries. And then, just as National Socialism, the idea was starting to spread like wildfire. And these people would come off the Western banking system. That was when they had to send in NATO, the heavy boys, to do exactly what I've just said, to remove all of those priceless assets of that country, to put the padlocks on the door, and to deny entry to the rightful, legitimate owners of that country. And what a mess Libya is today.
Yes, and Tom, I believe Tom emailed me, and he said ancient Sumerian clay tablets, when you're speaking of priceless assets, were destroyed during Gulf War II in order to erase Iraqi, Mesopotamian, Tamian, and Sumerian history. What a tragedy. What an absolute tragedy to do that.
They won't have any problem if there is any competition, and the competition does not necessarily come in human form. It may be that something, natural substance threatens the way things are. You know, people have often said, well, you know, you call it gas, we call it petrol, but some people have said, well, what happens if we invent a fuel that is not petrol, you know, then it couldn't happen. They will be put out of business. And this is exactly, you know, war by other means.
Or if you invent a car that runs on water, or if you actually say, oh, there's really free energy. We don't really need to have all of these companies that that charge us for something that is free, like the electricity, for instance, water. Look at the people that went about and bottled up all of this water. And then it's only people who have money that can get clean, good water. And we're now used to going to the store instead of to the tap to get our water. And you think, how did this happen? And
I'll tell you something revolutionary now, Diana. Had National Socialism prevailed, then there would be no such thing as the terrible diseases that afflict us today. Most of the diseases that we suffer from are self-inflicted, simply because it's lifestyle, and it is a lifestyle encouraged by the people who we pay to cure us when we suffer from the lifestyles that they have imposed upon us. Cancer would have been cured many years ago if National Socialism had prevailed, but the pharmaceuticals will not allow method of curing these, simply because if they do, well, do turkeys vote for Christmas? Of course they don't. And if anybody comes up, we were talking about petrol a moment ago, but if anybody comes up with a solution to any of these awful diseases that afflict us, then the pharmaceuticals will send NATO in again, believe me.
I do. Well, I believe that the Germans did have a cure for cancer, and there have been several other cures. In fact, there's a patent that is at least 100 years old in the U.S. Patent Office for a cure for cancer, and yet they conceal all of these And they vilify the doctors that try to help people, or they vilify them to the point they take them to court, or they send the government after them, the American Medical Association after them. So it's all about money. It's certainly all about money and control, definitely.
You wouldn't believe the control. You know, when I was talking a long time ago, just don't go there, but when I was very, very young, I thought I'm going to start set up a mail order company. I'm going to sell things through mail order and advertise an exchange in Mars, a small classified, and sell these things that I was buying from the wholesalers. Now, Deanna, I was one guy, I think I was 19 or 20 years old, and I'm operating from a bedsitter, you know, a very one-bed apartment. The bed was in the same room as the kitchen. Can you imagine the scene? You know, this is really bohemian. And, you know, the first letter that I got was from the Rockefeller Incorporated Banks or something along those lines from Wall Street, wanting to know if we could do business together. That's how far they can reach, and that has always stuck in my mind. There is one 19 or 20-year-old operating a one-man business from a bedsitter, never done business in his life before, a complete rookie, and those banks knew that I was there, and they wanted part of the slice of the cake, and that was long before the internet, of course.
Interesting. And of course, that's true with everything, with Tesla. And they got Edison borrowed money from the bankers, and so they supported him. Tesla said, "Nope, I don't need your money." And so they destroyed his lab, they destroyed him, and he died a pauper. And then the government came in and seized all of his research papers.
Yep, it goes on, and as I said before, it is war by other means, and it's not just the pillaging and the plunder that we normally associate with war. It is the denial of things that are in competition with what we are dependent on. People think that they have a democracy, whether we're talking about the United States or Europe. It's a load of rubbish. You know, we get the chance once every 5 years to go and vote. Believe me, the lobbyists in Washington and here in Europe, they are leaning on the politicians every single hour of the day. They never, ever give up. And they're not just giving the politicians the votes. They're giving them big fat meals, and they're giving them all kinds of cash and all the rest of it. We don't stand a snowflake's chance in hell when it comes to influencing the politicians. They couldn't care less about us. This is theatre. That's all it is. Every 5 years, it's theatre. I don't like the international socialists, but I do love a slogan of theirs: "Don't vote; it only encourages them."
How true! How true! And people really take this seriously. And I mean, I didn't participate at all. And people think, I'm sure that some people think that I'm unpatriotic or some silly thing like that, but you don't participate in the charade. Not that it's going to go away, because there's not enough people that really don't get it.
You've matured, lady, and an increasing number of people are maturing, and this is why, you know, I've always argued these people say, well, if you don't vote, you're not patriotic, and I say no. If you don't vote, then you're showing your preference that none of them are worth it.
That's true. Oh, that is so true. By the way, we will take your calls at 800-313-9443. And, of course, we'll take your email questions. Just email spingola1@yahoo.com. Or you can ask questions in the chat room. That's always a good place to ask a question. Hopefully I see them all. All righty. I was just reading another email, but it was about something that we talked about last week. Well, let's get back to your book, and Leon Degrelle. And Adolf Hitler said to Degrelle, and he was a Belgian Waffen SS officer. Hitler said, and I quote, if I had a son, I would have wished him to be like you. unquote. And this was a very courageous person who was a Belgian, and he thought that that Hitler was doing the right thing, and of course he was, and he was doing the right thing for his country, for his people, and the bankers certainly didn't appreciate that because they did not appreciate that he wanted that he took them out of the international banking system, threw the bankers out of the country, and said, "We do not need you." So we'll be right back in 3 minutes, and again, we will take your calls at 800-313-9443. Deanna, and our guest today is Michael Walsh, and he is the author of many wonderful books. And we were talking about Leon Degrelle, and he is just one of the people that Michael talks about. Did you want to say anything more about Degrelle? Maybe some of the things that he did, that he wrote, that he...
Yeah, I like Degrelle, and he had much in common with Adolf Hitler. He started life as a private, and even when he was, given a higher position, he refused to take it simply because he wanted to be one of the guys. But he ended up as being, and this is important, is one of the most talked about generals in the entire Axis armies. Now, for a Belgian private to reach such high levels of responsibility is probably unique in world history. And it wasn't just his bravery, because of course all men in all armed forces tend to be very, very brave. He was an extremely accomplished man. When he was very, very young, he studied law in the University of Louvain, of course, but he also studied Thomistic philosophy. He was an expert on art and archaeology and political science, and by the time he reached his 20th birthday, he was publishing his own newspaper. He published five of his own books, and this was at a time when it was much more difficult. You didn't have computers in those days. I couldn't be a writer in those days. And he became the leader of the Belgian Catholic Action Movement, and it was just up from there. But how many men with an intellect like that, and again, we're not talking politics, Diana, how many men with an intellect like that are so brave on the battlefield? When you learn of his bravery, his heroic deeds, fighting hand to hand, you just find that this is one of the most remarkable men in world history. Never mind the uniform that he was wearing. Let us honor these great men and these great women as we used to do in the conflicts of the past. I suppose the Second World War is perhaps the only conflict in world history in which we have never honored the fallen foe. And that is a crime not only against them, it's a crime against our own morality.
Indeed. And of course, it's because of the people that write the history of a war that they have to vilify everybody on the other side in order to justify their warfare against those people. Because if you all of a sudden bring out the truth about the wonderful people on the other side, you're going to get questions. Somebody's going to say, well, why would we fight these wonderful people? Why would we do this? Why would we vilify them? Then the Allies would certainly have to come up with an answer then, wouldn't they?
Yeah, and I wouldn't like those who are browsing Heroes of the Reich by myself, Michael Walsh, just to think that it's the book is only about people who wear uniform or they were only of German stock. This is simply not the case. You know, we had the most remarkable escapes such as that. They made movies about this guy. You can get it on a DVD, The Great Escape, by Clemens Forel. He was the guy who was captured. I think it was a Stalingrad, but I'm not absolutely clear of that. But he was taken to that part of Siberia where on a clear day you can see Alaska. You know, that's a long, long way away. And he walked. Now, he was wearing less clothes than you go out on a Sunday stroll. It took him about 5 years to organize his escape. And he walked through the Siberian tundra to liberty, and it took him, I think it was 8,000 miles in 3 years or the other way around. But that was one of the most remarkable, great stories of our time. Then you might remember the movie, The One That Got Away. This was Baron Franz von Vera, the Luftwaffe fighter pilot, who was such an escape artist in Britain when he was captured. They had to send him out to Canada. He went over the border, over the frozen river that separates Canada and the United States. He was held very, very much like Julian Assange today in the German embassy, because America wasn't at war at the time, but it was shaping up for this. And it was a very, very similar situation to Julian Assange, and they spirited him out. That was a wonderful story. And then the likes of Vidkun Quisling, or Quadrano of Romania, Arno Brecker, the great German sculptor, William Joyce, of course, Winifred Wagner, Herbert von Karajan. What about Norbert Schulz? Now, such a great composer of beautiful music, and of course, Charlie Brown on the Fritz Eagle story. There was an American pilot, a great story about him. Paula Hitler. You know, her statement about a big brother. So many wonderful people, wonderful examples. Elizabeth Schwarzkopf, not Hampson, wonderful people.
Indeed.
I get passionate, don't I? I get passionate, and then all of a sudden I stop. But that's the way life is.
Well, that's the poetry in you. That you are a poet, and it comes across whenever you talk.
Well, I try to follow Beethoven's example. He says, I speak heart to the heart. And that's what I try to do. My heart.
And you do it so well. All righty, we'll be back in 3 minutes with our guest, Michael Walsh. All righty, welcome back. This is Deanna. Our guest today is Michael Walsh. He is the author of his most recent book, Heroes of the Reich, and Diamonds Last Forever. And I hope that before the end of the program that you will share one of your poems with us. We can't let you get away without doing that.
Well, I got 300 of them here. If you've got the time, you know, I've got the time.
we could do a program just on your poetry and enjoy it very much.
Well, yeah, I hope you give me the opportunity sometime, you know, because, you know, I absolutely adore poetry, but the important thing is to me, is not so much that it's an indulgence. We all have our indulgences. It's that so many people enjoy, you know, the poetry. That's very, very gratifying to be able to share the gift. If it was a good singer, which of course I'm not, you can tell from the voice, or I played the violin, then it would be wonderful to have people appreciate it, and it's wonderful to have people to appreciate the poetry.
Yes, indeed. Well, just let me know when you have one at your fingertips that you would like to share. Now, most of what we hear about Germany centers around those concentration camps and all the evil commandants that that tortured people and put them in ovens and did all these horrible things, supposedly. And one of the first person in your book that you talk about is Rudolf Höss, the man, I'm probably not pronouncing that name correctly. I don't know how to pronounce those. What are those called? The two little dots?
I think it's Höss.
Höss. Okay. Anyway, you call him the man who defied British torture. And he was the commandant of Auschwitz.
Yeah, he had to be killed simply because he knew the truth about Auschwitz. And the truth was far different from what we're being told. You know, they even had social security payments there. They had an orchestra. They had post offices. They had education. They had a health system. They even had a legal system. But, of course, were not allowed any of that. So they had to get rid of the evidence. And, of course, there were not many people who were more evidential than Rudolf Höss. And he was, when he was captured, you know, the vengeful British they, as they did with so many captured Germans, I'm very, very sad to say, their brutality was enough to send, you know, to make your blood run cold. And people really should read this story, because then, whatever their political convictions are, they know a crime is a crime. And, you know, what they did to that commander defies belief. And I think I said in one of my books somewhere, don't ever fall into British or American hands. Just do what the British soldiers used to do in the first and the second Afghan wars, is just roll over, put the barrel of the gun to your head, and blow your brains out, because you're going to die anyway, but you're going to die out horribly. Better to go a quick way. And that's what Hoche should have done. He should never, ever have allowed himself to fall into the hands of the British. He should have took his own life.
Maybe he was just very naive, because people who don't typically treat others brutally don't think that that they're going to be treated brutally.
I think they were all very naive, and in this I include Adolf Hitler. I think that he was very naive. You know, that right up to the end of 1944, he genuinely believed that the British and the Americans would wake up to the threat of the Soviet Union invading Eastern Europe. He really didn't seem to accept that they were part and parcel of the Soviet Union. It had already been agreed that half of Europe was going to be handed over to the Soviet Union. And I just simply can't believe that in the goodness of his heart, Adolf Hitler was still naive enough to send emissaries saying that German troops would fight alongside American and Allied troops to keep the Soviet Union out of Europe. And that was the last thing that Roosevelt or Churchill wanted. It had already been agreed that that was part of the reparations policy, that 11 countries in Europe were to be handed over to the Soviet Union. They were to be incorporated into the biggest plantation the world had ever known. Naivety.
Yes. And it's amazing that people don't realize that Eisenhower was in on this whole plan, and that's why he stopped moving eastward, so that the Soviets could come in and liberate, quote unquote, liberate all these peoples. And I don't think Patton was in on it, General Patton, and of course that's why they had to assassinate him. Because he was going to go back to America and spill the beans about it, probably the same way that Pat Tillman was going to do. And both of those people being so popular, they would have been believed. But so they did capture Rudolf Höss, and he was at Nuremberg, and of course you say British and American hands, but when I was reading about the actual torture that they were conducting down in the basement, they actually got other people to do the torture, and a lot of them were people who had lived in Germany before and had left in 1933 and then went back with a vengeance. And these are a lot of Jewish lawyers, a lot of Jewish interrogators, because they spoke the language, and they were also very brutal. And they like to torture people.
Absolutely. The Nuremberg trials and the military tribunals, these were largely staffed. You know, when you look at the old newsreels now, you see an awful lot of the prosecution. There wasn't any defense anyway, but you see an awful lot of the prosecution in military uniforms. If you check and find out how many of them were legitimately worn, you'd be surprised how few of them were. These were Jewish lawyers drafted in from the Allied countries, and they were put into uniforms to give the appearance of them being military tribunals. They were absolutely nothing of the sort. They were just vengeful trials, and it was no different in actual fact. They were using the same Soviet prosecutors that had sent so many people to their deaths in Stalin's Russia, and these prosecutors were self-evident at Nuremberg and the military tribunals, and those Germans, and not just the Germans, the other people that were brought before them, they were just going through a charade. It was again a ritual, it was a theatre. They had no chance. This was not a legitimate court of law, just as you imagine them to be in the United States. They didn't have a defence. They didn't have anything of that nature. They were condemned to death before they walked in there.
Indeed. And after the fact, there were some people, Brits and also some Americans, that said, oh, if I'd known beforehand what the tribunal was going to be about, I never would have participated. But it's fine and dandy to say this after the fact, when all the damage has been done and people have forgotten, and it's published in some minor newspaper that nobody's ever going to read. And it's fine to say, well, that was a show trial. But people still think about the Nuremberg trials as something legitimate. In fact, wasn't there a movie made about it that was supposed to be kind of a docudrama and showing what happened?
Yeah, it's just more of the theater, wasn't it? But any reasoned analysis of the Nuremberg trials, I wish they wouldn't call them trials, but for want of a better name, the military tribunals too, they were absolutely fraudulent. And of course, the truth is coming out bit by bit. People are much smarter than they used to be. But, sometimes you hear a story about, what about the Germans who pretended that they didn't know what was going on? They were looking the other way. Well, I would turn this around, Diana, and I would say, what about the British and the Americans who knew what was going on? And still you know what was going on, and they won't say a word about it. Patton, a great general, was a bit of a rarity, because he signed his own death warrant when he said that he was going to come out of the military command and he was going to speak the truth in America. And that was that was signing his own death warrant. It happened with Lawrence of Arabia. As soon as they sided with the other side, they had an unfortunate accident. Lawrence of Arabia, of course, in a so-called motor accident in England, and, of course, Patton in Germany.
Indeed, yes. And these were very courageous people to come out against their country. But even in small ways, people should be standing up here in America and in other countries who are participating in warfare in the Middle East right now and say, no, this does not represent what I would want. But now if you talk about, if you have an anti-war mentality in America today, people think that you're not patriotic and that you're not supporting the troops. And, well, everybody knows we got to support those troops. And if you watch TV, which I don't do very frequently, but if you watch TV, there are advertisements about wounded warriors and about, and they get these celebrities to promote warfare, people like Gary Sinise and some of these other people who are very supportive of war, and you just have to wonder, don't you know what they're doing over there? I mean, seriously, we've been in Afghanistan for all this time, going on 12 years, and we're still there. Don't people ask questions? Or are they just distracted by everything else that's going on? And certainly we've had a huge distraction last Friday with the slaughter of these children at Sandy Hook.
Yeah, it's all marketing, and you're up against it. And thank goodness that you exist, Diana, with your wonderful radio station. You don't get anything as independent as that in Europe, I'm afraid. But it's people like yourself who are going to turn things around, and we're going to benefit from it as well. But the mass media, the conventional media, if you like to call it that, are masters of manipulation and social engineering. And of course, all of this building up our troops and fighting for freedom, you know, nobody really should be taken in by that. I love some of your American expressions like, you can't fix stupid. Right? How on earth is Syria any threat to the United States? So why is the United States involved there? Because it's not because of what the voters want, it's because of what the armaments industry want. And of course, it's what Israel wants.
Yes, and that is the biggest factor in everything that's ever gone on in the Middle East. They have, from the time that, well, even before the Balfour Declaration, in fact, several decades before the Balfour Declaration, they've had their eye on Palestine, and their idea of a greater Israel is to take over the entire Middle East. I mean, it's got a lot of resources. It's also strategically situated so that they can target Europe and they can target the United States. And apparently they can target other countries, well, Japan, and wherever there are people or a group that is against what they are doing.
One of these wars, Diana, is America is going to get a bloody nose, and it's all going to be backward from there on. You know, we've all been there before. All of the empires have been there before. Britain had SIRS, and, you know, the United States is just going to bite off more than it can chew, and it's going to get a good kicking. And, you know, whether this world will be a safer place or a more dangerous place after that happens, but their involvement in the Middle East now is really threatening a third world war. They are throwing oil on the fire, and, you know, I hesitate to forecast where on earth we are going. I just hope that it isn't going into the very first Holocaust that's ever threatened this world.
Right. Well, I think one of the purposes of World War II was to set up America as the military force and the dictator of the New World Order, so to speak.
Yeah, I hope you're going to end this program by playing the Jewish national anthem, and we're going to call it Onward Christian Soldiers.
Yes, indeed. No, I think we need to end with some poetry.
Yeah, so okay. we'll do that. I love the poetry, but it's always an enlightening program, and it's an inspiring program, because hopefully it encourages us all to think. Because if we just take things as they're preached to us, then we're going to find ourselves in exactly the same boat in 10 years' time.
Right. Yes, indeed. Well, do you have a poem that we can go into the break with?
Okay, I'm going to give you a happy one, because if I'm given the time to do a longer one, it'll be a little bit sad. Okay, so this is called Let Us Kick the Sky. Take my arm and let us go upon our merry way, and I shall whistle happy tunes to lift our feet of clay. One step forward, then again, let's kick our toes up high. We shall be so fun-filled, dear, we'll poke them at the sky. Don't be slow, as off we go, your breast, my upper arm. A comfort to my soul and heart, I sense your inner warmth. And I will banter with you, dear, and lightly dance you may, as we together, always one, go on our merry way. How your laughter makes lighter the skies and to the heart. I loved you from the moment we made our happy start. If you sometimes turn to thought that journey's end will be for naught, raise your face and lift your heart. We'll both go back and repeat the start.
Oh, that was just delightful. Absolutely delightful.
And delight.
It isn't just the words. It's the feeling that you bring to the words. It's the way you it's your voice. I think that Taffy, probably all of the females in the listening audience are just enthralled with your voice.
Well, we never see ourselves as others see us. I think it was Robbie Burns who coined that phrase, the greatest gift God can give us is to see ourselves as God, you know, as people see us. And it's a wonderful statement. It's nice to have the poetry, you know, respected and enjoyed.
Oh, absolutely.
If I do get another one, it's going to be a bit sad.
Get
the Kleenex out.
Okay, when we come back from the break, which we are going to in just a few seconds, then you can do the sad one. Okay? All right.
It's always a great pleasure talking with you and with our American friends. Go back.
All righty. When we come back, we'll hear the sad one. Be right back in 3 minutes. All righty. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and Michael is going to share a poem with us that you might need a tissue at the end.
Yeah, well, I don't know anything about your care system for the elderly in the United States. I know it's not, it leaves a lot to be desired in Europe, Deanna. And when I talk with old folk, they very often say, I don't want to end up in a care home. I don't want to be ending up being looked after by other people. I want to just go quickly or hopefully in my sleep. And it was this that inspired the final journey. And if you can picture in your mind an elderly man, and he's reached the stage where his wife can no longer look after him, he's too infirm, and he really does have to go off to a residential home. And he doesn't want her to know that he is going and he won't be coming back, but of course she knows, and that's what the poem is all about, final journey. Yes, may I speak it?
Yes, please.
Okay. I placed my glasses down somewhere. There's a rapping at the door. He heard his wife say softly, "It's the other door, my dear." He wasn't always that way, and I'm glad that they can't see. His friends have gone before him, but he's still as dear to me. Yet he once led them from the front when courage showed the way. But since their dreams were answered, they've all gone far away. "I'll not be long," he told her, but inwardly she cried. "Oh, I found my glasses, Milda," and they led him kind outside. Her shoulders fell, he knew quite well that he was too old to turn. Oh, that God might claim him soon, for he will not return.
Yikes. Well, that is very sad. And so many people.
It is a little bit sad, isn't it?
Yes. And many people will experience that.
Yeah. Well, I got time for just a quick one to make you happy.
Yes.
Okay. It's the unseen guest. There's a skeleton inside me. Perhaps you didn't know. It stays with me both night and day. It goes everywhere I go. You may tease, but as I say, I tell you it is true. And if you have a mind to know, there's one inside you too. At exercise, it's not the best, and when it bends, it groans. It's only what you might expect, but it is only bones. If they took me all away and left their bones to see, perhaps you'd better know, my dear, the other part of me. Now, if we have a skeleton inside of you and me, let's make no bones about it. We never want it free. Unseen, unloved, devoted, it is with us to the breath. We breathe our last, our twosome joined by someone known as death. You'd be thinking I'd talk of nothing else but death.
Wow. I want to thank you very much for sharing. I want to end with something that somebody in the chat room said. Hitler said, "If I had a son, he would be like Leon Degrelle." Obama said, "If I had a son, he would be like Trayvon Martin." Doesn't that say a lot about these two gentlemen?
It really does say an awful lot about them, doesn't it? You know, we haven't got a great deal to be proud of in the leadership then or now.
Yes. Well, Michael, we've run out of time.
That is a great shame. It is always lovely to be invited. Yours is the greatest party of my year.
Ah, oh, you're so sweet. All righty. We'll talk soon. Thank you so much.
And happy Christmas to everybody.
Same to you.
Thank you, darling.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye, listeners. Talk with you tomorrow.
Here at Republic Broadcasting Network, we have been building our online store. While we have been focusing on bringing you the best talk show host in the country, here at Republic Broadcasting Network, we also want our listeners to have products they can use every day and in times of emergency. We have added new products each week to our store. Your support of this network, plus products at the best prices, is a win-win situation. Check out our new store. Go to our website, republicbroadcasting.org, and click on the online store located at the top of our website. Together, we can continue to grow RBN and help our listeners prepare for the future. Go to republicbroadcasting.org and click on our online store or call us at 1-877-605-9200.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network because you can handle the truth.